committee meeting bright and early on a Monday morning.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that early, really.
It's not that bright either.
Yeah. Those of us raising the fire now that 9 o'clock, almost lunchtime. This morning we're going to receive a report on older driving, the older driver study. Then we're going to work on a couple of bills, and if we can find agreement on the committee, we'll move those bills out. To get started this morning, we're going to have Kelly Taylor and Marty Miller come up and talk about the older driver's advice. Committee members, you should have a notebook at your place. Identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Taylor with the Department of Transportation, and my part today is to introduce the lady who's going to give you the report and who worked on the study. This is Maury Miller. Maury is the manager of our program services group at DMV, and program services encompasses driver, vehicle, and business regulation policy within DMV. Maury was on the advisory committee that did the study. She was a non-voting member and knows the study very, very well and the recommendations that came from it. So I will turn it over to Maury to give you the report. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. I know Kelly's already introduced me, but for the record, my name is Maury Miller, and I'm the manager of program services at DMV. You have before you the department's report of a year-long study that was conducted to consider the effects of aging on driving ability and to develop a comprehensive plan for licensing older drivers. In the time we have this morning, what I'm going to try to do is just pull out for you the key recommendations and specifically those that will require some legislative action this session. In developing the proposals, the department had the help of a 13-member citizens advisory committee that represented a wide spectrum of diverse interests of people throughout the state who have a special interest in older drivers, and I chaired that committee as a non-voting member. I can say that in my 25 years of government service that this was the best stakeholder group that I've had the privilege of working with. They were very respectful of the diverse points of view of the many interest groups, and they worked very diligently to reach consensus on 26 recommendations, which is no small task and a subject that is this complex. A number of the committee members are with us today in the audience, and I think we all owe them our thanks for helping the department and helping you, the policymakers, decide what policy changes, what new focuses might need to be introduced to have a positive impact on driver safety for our aging population. Based upon the advisory committee's report, the department has outlined a strategic plan that includes two stages. With your approval, we propose that stage one be implemented this legislative session and that we would act on stage two in the next legislative session. To implement stage one, there is one statutory change that is required, as well as passage of House Bill 2139, which is a fee bill for the funding, and also the budget authority for $1,035,000. Those packages are currently before the Ways and Means Subcommittee. Stage one consists of five initiatives, and that would be the stage for this legislative session. And it would implement 23 of the 26 recommendations that came from the advisory group. The first initiative we call more and better screening and evaluation. The study found, and this is a very important finding of the study, the study found that age alone is not a good predictor for identifying at-risk drivers. What we do know is that visual, cognitive, and functional abilities decline with age, but that decline and the severity of the decline is widely diverse between individuals. But there is a very promising tool that is out on the market now that could help the department screen for visual, cognitive, and functional abilities, and it's called the Useful Field of View test. The test consists of a computer screen that shows various objects like cars and trucks and other objects that the tester is asked to identify in a field of distractions that simulate what it's like to actually drive a car around. That particular test has been very successful in a medical setting. They've particularly been successful in helping people relearn how to drive who've had problems in driving. But it has not been adequately tested in a DMV setting. And so the department is proposing that the useful field of view be piloted in several offices. I think our current proposal is 4 offices. Before we attempt to go statewide with something that is so new to the industry, there's no legislation required for us to do this pilot. However, we would need approximately $130,000 to conduct the pilot. There are a number of important recommendations in the study that rely on a successful pilot and the implementation of the useful field of view. And so the department is not recommending that we go forward with those recommendations until the useful field of view has been proven to be successful. An example of that is right now, Oregon renews driver's license every 8 years. And the proposal by the advisory committee is that following the 65th birthday, renewals would be every 4 years, and that at that time they would be tested with the useful field of view. So that proposal will not come forward this session until we know how effective the useful field of view is. The last component in the more and better screening category includes several proposals to strengthen the department's existing medical reexamination program. And the department has already made some internal changes to reduce backlogs and to try to increase the timeliness or improve the timeliness. But efficiencies alone are not going to help us where that's concerned, because we only have 6 driver improvement counselors, and we have been inadequately staffed in that area for a number of years. So the department has requested $112,000 for 1 additional driver improvement counselor to help us reduce the backlogs in that area and to keep them down. The second initiative is called public awareness, and that's so that individuals and communities can help solve the problem of older drivers. The advisory committee very clearly communicated that government alone cannot solve this problem. And so they proposed a number of recommendations for DMV to partner with other communities to produce tools that will help communities manage this problem. For example, we might develop assessment tools that would be used. We would increase the public awareness. We would implement education and outreach strategies throughout the state. And under this initiative, what we would do is we would keep the advisory committee process operating that we started this last year to come up with the recommendations, and those working groups would produce the products that are necessary for us to distribute to the community. I'll give you an example of that so you can see how it might work. Many older drivers, they will modify their driving habits because they recognize that their physical and functional abilities are declining. But then there's other older drivers and impaired drivers who don't even recognize they're having a problem. The nature of their disability prevents them from even recognizing they have a problem. Well, DMV, with the help of these advisory groups, could develop a self-assessment tool that families could use, the individual could use, social service agencies and other health care providers could use, that would help determine whether the person should be considering curtailing their driving activities. And in the policy option package, we have requested $190,000 for 1 additional staff member who would facilitate these various groups and help with the community outreach and the public awareness campaign. The third initiative is to improve medical referral forms and to publicize DMV's current medical reexamination program, and to increase our efforts to provide information on adaptive devices and driving rehabilitation that would be available through our driver improvement program. We have asked for $80,000 for everything that's in that initiative. An example there is that our medical referral form that the physicians use to report impaired patients to us does not really get us all the information that we need to have to make our decisions. It's not a particularly user-friendly form. And so we have gathered some forms from other states, and the committee feels that, like, the Missouri form is a very good one. We'll adapt our form to be more user-friendly. Another thing is that oftentimes people feel that if you're an older driver and can no longer, let's say you can't feel pressure anymore on your feet because you have significant diabetes, you shouldn't be using your feet to accelerate or brake if you can't feel. However, there have been adaptive devices out in the communities for years that are used by amputees for hand controls and other ways to drive. And so rather than just taking away the license of an older driver, we feel that there should be some effort to help older drivers, not that DMV would necessarily do this, but it would be a community effort to make sure that there's resources out there for older drivers to access some of these tools that would help them continue driving. The fourth initiative involves training department staff, healthcare professionals, and police officers to better recognize the physical and mental conditions that impair driving. For example, currently DMV field staff relies primarily on self-reports from people as they're coming in for to renew as to whether they have an impairment that might affect their driving ability. Without specialized training, what a DMV worker can actually observe during such a brief interaction at a field counter is just very limited. And so what the committee proposed is that DMV field staff be trained in conducting something that's called a screen for gross impairment. It doesn't take a very long time, but it does require some specialized training, and you need to set aside a certain amount of time. And so what we would like to do is train our staff in doing that and include that as a step in all of the face-to-face interactions we have at DMV counters. And that would increase the time in the field offices that we would need to have four additional FTE, the equivalent of four positions, for $290,000. The fifth and final initiative in the first stage is to increase the number of reports from outside sources about impaired drivers. This is a very key component of this strategy, and to implement this component, we will require legislative action on your part. ORS 897-710 currently specifies who must report impaired drivers and what conditions must be reported. The study found, however, that these conditions are pretty limiting in that only doctors who treat people who might lose consciousness have to report. So, for example, a person who has visual impairment or loss of memory or have lost their strength or coordination of the upper or lower extremities, those individuals do not have to be reported. And so during the study, the department also learned that the medical community has some concern about confidentiality and civil liability if they were to report at-risk patients. And so we would also need to address that in the statute as well. The department is asking this committee for legislation that would give us administrative rulemaking authority to establish what impairments and who must report those impairments to the department. We feel that we can utilize the scientific community, the medical community, and we can put together a program that will maximize the number of reports we get without it being overly burdensome on the medical community. And the department did not have the opportunity to submit this as a concept because the older driver advisory committee report and our analysis of the report has just recently been concluded. We estimate that this final initiative in the first stage will cost approximately $224,000. In conclusion, the older driver study clearly indicates that Oregon needs better screening and more reporting of impaired drivers. We also need better training for those who have to identify at-risk drivers and to increase public awareness of what they can do to help identify at-risk drivers. We also learned that the complexity and scope of the recommendations is such that we need to phase in the recommendations in a two-stage process that begins this legislative session and concludes in the 72nd session in 2003. We believe that the recommendations that I outlined just a few minutes ago will allow all of us to work towards better ways of identifying at-risk drivers and at the same time honoring the dignity and the mobility needs of our older citizens in the state. And that concludes my remarks, and Kelly and I are here to answer any questions that you might have. Did I misspeak myself on the statute?
Here goes, Stephanie.
Representative Murphy has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Three of these areas involve increased reporting by the medical community, or at least it sounds as if they do. Public awareness notes that we need strategies to assist physicians in reporting impairments. Forms and publicity suggest the need to better elicit information from the person's health care provider, and increased reporting directly addresses reporting from the health care professionals' concerns or about the driver. Was the medical field well represented on this study, and what kinds of issues were raised and wrestled with in regard to having one's health care provider become a reporting mechanism to the state on one's personal health?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, we did have quite a few interactions with the medical community on this issue. They were invited to participate in the advisory committee, but because of the schedules that physicians normally have, they served rather as consultants, and they also presented expert testimony to the group on several occasions. We have the type of feedback that we got from the medical community was that currently the statute, there is something in the statute that does currently require physicians to report on conditions that result in a patient losing consciousness. And so it's already in the statute. So what we were recommending that include other types of conditions that would affect driving, such as vision and loss of memory or loss of strength or coordination of the extremities. The medical community acknowledged in the testimony that was before our advisory committee that these were problems that needed to be reported. Their concern was that of confidentiality, and that if they either reported a patient or they didn't report a patient, what kind of civil liability would they be under? So our proposal would be that the statute would deal with the issue of confidentiality and also provide immunity to the medical community for reporting patients that are at risk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Loss of consciousness is a fairly narrow issue, but when one throws in loss of strength, eye impairment, memory, or ability to concentrate, one now has a very broad focus. Is there any concern that citizens would not want, might start not wanting to go to their physician for concerns if the physician over such a broad range is reporting their personal medical information to the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, that's a very good question. It's one that we discussed at the advisory committee. And the reason why our recommendation for legislation is to do this as a rulemaking process is so that the rules can actually be fashioned by and developed with the assistance of the medical community and other healthcare providers, so that they can be narrowly, they can be looked at in a way that will not interfere with the patient, doctor-patient relationship. Another thing that I would say to somebody who has that concern is all that happens when a physician makes such a referral is the person comes in, meets with a driver improvement counselor at DMV who would do a different type of screening to really determine if whatever was being reported actually affected driving ability. So the doctor is not, by making the report, essentially saying the person can no longer drive. What they're doing is saying, I have a concern that the severity of this person's condition is going to affect their ability to drive. And that would be, in their professional judgment, something they would do. Right now, family members do that. Right now, some physicians do that on a voluntary basis.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Miller and Ms. Martin, I want to applaud the department for putting this work group together. I think it's safe to say this is one of the more controversial areas that the last session dealt with, and obviously it raises a lot of issues of autonomy of older drivers. My question to you is, did the work group look at what other states are doing in their licensing process, and specifically things like the useful field of view test? Is that something that's in place in any other state, or are some of these recommendations modeled on successful changes that motor vehicle licensing has gone through in other places that have proven to work?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, yes, we did look at other states, and the useful field of view is, right now there's only one other state that is looking at it, and they're piloting it also. It is a very new tool for the DMV setting. It's been used for a number of years in the medical setting to determine whether somebody, the primary use it's had is to help people relearn how to drive. And in the process of using it for that purpose, you know, by rehab counselors, they have identified ways that it can be used to identify people who have the problems in the first place. So it's something that we don't believe, we believe it has a lot of promise because it's been written up in the AMA journals and it has a lot of research behind it, but we don't think it's a good idea to go statewide with something like that if it hasn't been tested in another state. The other recommendations in the plan, we are modeling things after other states. So our forms were modeling after Missouri. We've got a self-assessment tool that we've received from, I don't know if it's Missouri or Maryland. There's a number of things that best practices that we've picked up from other states. But right now, Oregon is actually on the leading edge on this subject and many other subjects when it comes to driver safety. So most states are actually looking to us right now, and we're being invited to come and talk about the older driver advisory recommendations. And we get more phone calls from other states than we've been able to gather information from other states.
Follow-up, Mr.
Yes,
Chair. And specifically in the area of requiring more frequent testing, whether it be visual testing or simply coming in more frequently to be licensed, that obviously is a sensitive area, but did you look at what other states, how Oregon fell in the spectrum of other states? And
right. Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, yes, we did look at other states. There are quite a few states that have age-based requirements, but the studies have shown that age-based requirements are not in and of themselves very predictive or very helpful. In fact, there was a study done in Europe where I think it was Sweden and Finland. I might be wrong on that, so forgive me if I am, but there were two very similar countries. One had no restrictions whatsoever on who could apply, when they could apply, and so on. And the other had a very age-based, you had to do this at this age and you had to do that at that age. And there was absolutely no difference between the accident rates and other things associated with it. The plan we have is one that builds upon community awareness and builds upon tools for people to self-report, or family members to report, or others who are concerned to report and say, "We need, this person needs to be looked at to determine if they do need some help or if they truly should not be driving anymore." And our, the research of the study indicated that that is the best approach. There's only a couple of states that follow that approach, and Oregon is one of them. But the program we have to do that was started, was it in the 80s? I don't.
Yes, it was
started in the early 80s with 6 driver improvement counselors, and we still only have 6 driver improvement counselors. And so the program is there, but it hasn't been effectively operated. And we heard the advisory committee loud and clear. They were not very complimentary of the department, and rightfully so, that we had, we needed to make improvements in that area. And so that is one of our recommendations, and have been working on it for the past year to reduce backlogs.
Thank you.
President Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Taylor and Ms. Miller, I'm grateful for everything you've done that helps us senior citizens drive more safely, do anything more safely and efficiently while continuing quality lives. And thank you very much. For those who are here who worked on this, appreciate it very much. Would it be possible on your testimony where you have study results, since we talk in terms of percentages, to put numbers to those? Because I don't know numbers compared to, you know, a certain percent of these people, 5% or 39%. I don't know what that equates to as far as numbers. Perhaps if you don't have it today, maybe you could provide that.
The percentages of the driver population.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I don't have the numbers with me today, but I can try to get some more numbers around that. Maybe we could contact you and find out specifically what it is that you're wanting.
Yes, ma'am. If you could please just turn the percentages into numbers.
Okay. Sure.
So we would have some idea. I don't know if we're talking about 10,000 or 300, or, and I would appreciate it. Probably others of the committee know, but I just do not know what those numbers equate to. And may I continue, please, Mr.
Yes,
Chair?
Yes, go
ahead. How, in the realm of driving and insurance, was the insurance community a part of this study?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson. We had an advisory group and another group that was called a stakeholder group. We had so much interest in this committee, we didn't want to turn anybody away. And so we had a number of insurance representatives on our stakeholder group. What they did, the stakeholder group came and made presentations to the advisory group. And so a number of the insurance industry came and did that. They also came to many of the meetings and participated, but not as committee members. They essentially provided us with an awful lot of good data that was used by the committee.
Follow up, please.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Miller, I'm curious of what you know, parameters or requirements insurance companies have on us seniors as we, you know, gain ages, as far as, you know, renewing our insurance policies or restrictions or requirements that they may have.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I do not have that information right here, but I can talk with some in the insurance industry and see if there is, are any requirements. I know that there are things such as 55 Alive, which are driver improvement programs, that persons can take to reduce the cost of their premium, but I don't know if there's any requirements as you are describing them, things that people have to do. Are you aware of any?
No, it would be somebody from the insurance industry that needed to contact her.
Yeah.
Representative Virgin?
Yes. Ms. Miller, thank you very much for a good report. I think that the study was an excellent idea. I think it looks like you've done a lot of good work. Actually, you didn't find a lot of legislation necessary out of the study, and I think it gives us a lot of good information. However, I'm very troubled as to the budgetary items here that you would need, because this is a time when the Department of Motor Vehicles is actually putting seniors out on the road by closing offices. On the South Coast, they're driving 18 miles. In one area of eastern Oregon, they're having to drive 70 miles. So we're in a high retirement area. So I guess that I'm wondering, is the policy option package money totally designated to that and cannot be used for maintaining offices that would keep seniors from having to drive long distances even in the winter?
Mr. Chair, Representative Virger, the policy option package includes a wide variety of funding requests. One of the requests within it is a safety request, is a safety package, so to speak, and $1,035,000 of that is specifically designated for the older driver issue. I don't believe that there would be, the way it has been designed, it wouldn't be that we would use any of that $1,035,000 for keeping offices open. It would be specifically for the things that I've outlined here. That's the way they are described in the policy option package. But there are other funds that have been requested in the policy option package for maintaining services at DMV.
Just quick follow-up. I'm sure you can see my concern in that while you're closing offices, that actually in my district and in other districts are putting older drivers out on the road and in some cases a detriment in inclement weather. So thank you very much for your comments.
That's a very good point, Representative Berger. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I do have one question. The $1 million, is it in the governor's budget?
Yes.
$1 million that are...
Mr. Chair, yes, it is.
It is in the governor's budget. Good to know. And just to clarify to your committee members, in the one sheet you got, it was, you noted that it was ORS 897, it is 807.
Yes.
In your notebook, it's 807, we checked the statute.
Yes.
So you know.
I didn't. Sorry about that.
Thank you for your testimony today, and thank you to all of those that participated. Appreciate your work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. With that, we will proceed to the rest of our agenda. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2138. John, would you like to explain it to our committee members?
Yes, Chair Starr and members of the committee. House Bill 2138 prohibits disclosure of personal information by Department of Transportation to bulk distributors unless authorized by the individual. It will also allow the option to an individual who wants their personal information to be released for bulk distribution. House Bill 2138 will bring Oregon into conformity with federal law.
Kelly Taylor is on the hot seat again. Or? And this is Kelly Taylor.
I can only hope, sir. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill Seeley with DMV. I'm here today to talk about House Bill 2138 and why the Department of Transportation asked for this bill to be introduced. The bill is intended to bring us into compliance with federal law, which requires states to discontinue providing record information for the purpose of direct marketing unless the person has given specific permission to the department to do so. Current law, we have something called an opt-out. DMV records are provided to bulk distributors of marketing materials and solicitations unless a person has opted out, in other words, stated that they do not wish to have their information provided in that manner. We've been doing that opt-out process since 1989. Once opted out, then we screen them out of any time we prepare a records list for the purpose of direct marketing or surveys or solicitations. They are simply not provided on that list. About 70% of DMV customers have opted out of this, which leaves about 30% that we are still providing on records lists. We've been doing that since 1989. There was federal legislation in 1994 that became effective in 1997 called the Driver Privacy Protection Act, which at a federal level also cemented that idea. That federal law was amended last year to say, let's switch it around. Instead of opting out of that, let's start with the premise that people don't want their personal information provided for that purpose, but if they do, allow them to opt in. That was amended into federal law that we are obligated to follow. And so what this bill does is it reverses the same thing for Oregon, where we're stating instead of having to opt out that we will consider that your personal information is not available for solicitations and direct marketing materials unless you specifically give us permission to include you on any records lists like that. Right now, we have a variety of methods in place to pretty well aggressively advertise the opt-out option. Some of that was directed by former legislative committees in the past as a desire for DMV to be pretty aggressive about that. We would discontinue actually all of those activities and just include in our general information that the opt-in opportunity exists. We don't want to put a lot of resource into that because we don't believe that there will be very many people who actually choose to opt in to have their DMV information used for this purpose. So we would make sure that people were aware, but we would not be aggressively targeting individuals to let them know that they have the opt-in opportunity. If this bill passes, it does have an emergency clause because the federal legislation is effective for Oregon on April 8th of this year. So we did ask for an emergency clause with this. If it were to pass, then what would happen is on that day, DMV would stop providing any kind of records list because obviously no one would have had an opportunity to opt in at that point. And we'd put a process in place to handle any requests for opting in. Our belief is that there will be few people who will do that. And so in effect, what this means is that DMV would not be in the business of providing records lists for both distribution of marketing materials and surveys and solicitations. Mr. Chair, that concludes my comments.
Well, thank you very much. Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Seeley, why would the Oregon Department of Transportation be in this business anyway? What does it have to do with roads or road safety to be given out distribution lists to begin with? I mean, what on earth are we doing? We're not a marketing group, are we, in the Department of Transportation?
No, ma'am. Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, that question has been asked many times over the years. DMV records are subject to the public records laws, which makes our information generally available and for really any purpose. Up until 1997, when Oregon law was amended to match the Federal Driver Privacy Protection Act, information from DMV was available to just about anyone for any purpose. The Driver Privacy Protection Act closed that off to a large degree, where neither you nor I can walk into a DMV office any longer and get information on Representative Rosenbaum, for example.
thankfully.
But since we've been around, we have been providing records lists for that purpose. The federal law did not prohibit it, and the legislative work group and committees in 1997 that dealt with this issue felt that with the opt-out provision in, which is one reason why they wanted us to aggressively advertise that, that anyone who didn't take advantage of that must want their information used for that purpose. So go ahead and leave it in place. But we didn't start out attempting to, yes, we want to be in this business. It was really a consequence of the public records law.
Representative Donner.
Just to follow up on Representative Nelson, thank you, Mr. Chair. Was there money involved? Were you getting money for these lists?
Yeah,
you were selling those.
Mr. Chair and Representative Donner, yes, in fact, all of our public records are provided on an actual cost recovery basis. There are no records that we provide for free to anyone, including law enforcement, which is something that came about with the change in the Oregon Constitution in 1980 with the limited use of highway funds. Since that time, we've been doing an actual cost recovery for everything that we provide.
Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I wanted to follow up. I'll follow up Representative Zahner's question since that was my second question. I'd like to know who authorized this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I'm not sure I understand.
Well, I'm assuming that there's a line of authority in the Department of Transportation. I would just like to know who authorized that, this information be used as a revenue center for DMV. And, it went beyond given information. It became a revenue center. Is that true? And I just wonder who authorized it. Was this authorized by a commission or, how this happened?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, specific to the revenue, it does generate revenue, but it's not a profit maker. In other words, all of the prices that we set are for actual cost recovery. It's whatever it costs us out of the highway fund. That came about, as a consequence of the public records law that said this information must be available, and then the change that occurred in the Oregon Constitution in 1980 that identified this as not an appropriate use for highway funds meant we had to recover all of our costs in order to provide the records. So it wasn't a conscious decision on someone's part to say we want to make this a revenue producer. In fact, it really is just a cost recovery. Have I answered your question?
No, sir. Mr. Stevie, what I'm concerned about is where does the authorization for an agency to participate in an activity like this come from? The governor?
I might be able to answer your
Thank
question.
Thank you.
The statutes, current statutes, require that the information that the DMV collects is a public document, public information. So it was authorized, I think, by the statutes that those of us in this building enact over the many years of the state of Oregon. That helps. And that's why we're changing the statute.
Thank you.
Bring ourselves into line with the federal statute.
Thank you, Chairman Starr. My concern is that the use of the data, which is public information, as I assume, was not used for the purpose of highway safety transportation for which you gather this information. I'm assuming it was given to any usable by any outside direct mail, magazine, solicitation companies, anybody. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, yes. In fact, prior to 1989, when we didn't have an opt-out law, then everyone's record information was available for that purpose, as the chair has pointed out, based on Oregon's public records laws that affect the Department of Transportation records. In 1989, when we adopted our first opt-out, then as customers have opted out of that, their information has not been provided in that way. But then anyone that didn't, that information was available to anyone who wanted to provide you with a mailing for any reason.
Representative Merkley has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I realize that this bill is coming about due to federal action, but if it wasn't, I would salute us doing it simply as a state, because I feel like opt-in is a much firmer foundation for personal privacy than opt-out. So I'm glad we're getting there through whatever means. My question is in regard to the fiscal analysis. If the sales were based, if the cost of selling the list was based on cost recovery, then shouldn't the loss of revenues also be reflected in equivalent saving and expenditures?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, that's something that we struggle with each session for records bills. While it is true that it's an actual cost recovery, many of the resources that are used to produce records at DMV are used broadly across the record spectrum. And if you have a certain portion of the records that are no longer available, you don't have a linear relationship between if it costs $2 to do that, you don't necessarily see a $2 reduction in the cost to provide that, because it's using either computer programs or people that already have other work that they're doing. There would have to be a significant chopping of the effort at DMV put into producing records before you start to see more of a lining up of the revenue and the expenditures. So what this will mean is that once we take this piece out of our the work that we do, our portfolio as it were with records, then we will have to reassess whether other things need to be increased or decreased because of the effect of this.
Mr. Chair, it sounds to me like you're saying then that what we were charging people was a share of the overhead it took to produce it, not a marginal cost, and therefore we don't have marginal savings when we eliminate the activity.
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, that's a fair way to categorize it, although most of that overhead is really direct. It's direct charges. It's just kinds of direct charges that are spread across many activities.
Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Seeley, what, if we're going to call it revenue or cost, I'm not sure right now, but what does this amount to a year for this program?
We were given a fiscal analysis. We should have received it. Hospital 2138. It says how much.
So we would assume that where's the data? 2138. Sorry, I'm just not know how to read it.
Okay. Do you have a copy of there?
Not of that, Mr. Chair, but it should match the numbers that I have.
Actually,
here.
I just have John can just go over it with it.
For the 2001-2003 biennium, it shows on service and supplies a debit of $490. Effect on revenues from sale of bulk distribution lists is debit of $94,500. Then projection for 2003-2005 on service and supplies, $665,000. And the effect on revenue sales from bulk distribution lists, $126,000 debit.
And my understanding that primarily is just because we're not going to be selling the list anymore.
That's right. And Mr. Chair, the figures that Mr. Leon just read to you constitute about half of the kinds of records that we provide in a similar manner that cost that much. So that represents about half of the revenue coming in from that particular activity.
Thank you. Representative Nelson, did that answer your question?
Yes, sir.
Great. Thank you.
What I found is that, you know, Mr. Chair, Mr. Seeley, is many times what the numbers that we talk about are different from the numbers that the agency talks about, and that was why I was anxious to hear what Mr. Seeley you know, thought it was from his viewpoint. What concerns me is that this continues. I mean, we have, you know, several more years. And how do we, or can we not cease and desist today?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, for this particular activity of providing the names on direct mail solicitations, that would stop upon signing by the governor. So I can't stop it today, but it can be stopped very soon.
Thank you very much for your testimony today. I don't see any other questions. Is there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill 2138? Not seeing anyone jump to their feet, I will close.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We'll close the public hearing on 2138. I'll open a work session. House Bill 2138.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 2138 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Should this vote be unanimous, I will make a second motion to put this on the consent agenda.
We have discussion now. Representative Rosenbaum.
I think this would probably be a question to staff or perhaps even to the department, but I guess the thing that I'm not clear about is we will obviously and are required by federal law stop releasing these records, but we will still allow people in some method to opt in to say that they want their records to be I would anticipate very few people are going to call up and say, I want my name and address given out so that people can send me solicitations. But is there still an issue under the public records law that to the extent we may have people that do that, that the state, that the DMV will be required to release that information or sell that information? I mean, and I think it sort of follows up on Representative Nelson's question, are we actually stopping this practice and can we legally stop this practice? Because my understanding is there are these complicated constitutional issues or at least public records issues that got us into this to begin with.
Representative Rosenbaum, my understanding is that for those folks that opt in, then I know that would be, you know, upon request, would be allowed or required to release those folks' information. Is that, I have nods from the,
yes,
the agencies in the audience.
But just to follow up, Mr. Chair, at that point, it would only be people who had affirmatively contacted ODOT saying, Diane Rosenbaum, want advertisers or anybody else that wants to know about me to have my name and address. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And secondarily, since it would be an opt-in only, the number of vendors that might request the list from DMV would probably be severely diminished because their purpose is much greater, the greater representation that the list has. I think actually this is probably not the right committee for it, but if you get into public information law and what information is public information, I think the average legislator would probably be very surprised in terms of any of your records with county assessors are public information, the property you own, the status of your tax payments, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, Mr. Chair, to follow Representative Rosenbaum's question, and perhaps Representative Devlin can help straighten out my head, is it not possible to cease and desist this practice, period, and end this unessential, costly service that the DMV is involved in that has nothing to do with highway safety or transportation in any way whatsoever, which is not in line with, you know, their mission, the department's mission, and protect also the privacy of a citizen, all citizens. I mean, is it by statute not possible our, do we need a memoriam to Washington, D.C. to, you know, further secure this right of privacy for our citizens? How do we end this practice?
I understand you feel strongly about the bill. Nelson, but let's get this bill passed, okay. Get an emergency clause, the governor will sign it, and then only folks that opt into the program will have to worry about their privacy. The rest of us will be taken care of. So I think that your concerns, you go a long way toward meeting with this bill right here, and it's got an emergency clause on it, which means it goes into effect upon state insurance. That's that crap.
Well, Mr. Chair, I want to follow up with her. I think the question she's asking is, why can't we just stop doing this now as a matter of policy within the agency in addition to passing the bill? And in my mind, I can't think of a reason why the agency could just say, we're going to discontinue this as a policy, unless you've already got requests in and build and lists being generated right now. I would think you ought to be able to stop, wouldn't you?
Mr. Chair, please. Representative Krupp, Bill Seeley with DMV. We wouldn't object to that, there's nothing that would prevent you from doing that.
Okay.
We believe that this, in effect, would do that because, as Representative Devlin pointed out, unless a substantial number of people opted in, there wouldn't be any value in the list.
Right.
But
okay.
That could have been another choice in how this bill was drafted, is just to say don't do it because we don't believe that anyone would.
That answers my question. Thank you.
Can you stay for a second? But just to be clear here, I don't think the department could do this without legislative authority, because under current statute, you're essentially obliged under both the language of Section 14 and public record laws in general to make this information available.
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, that is correct. This bill would need to be amended to just simply say we don't do it, period.
Right. Thank you. Pass the bill. We've got a motion on the floor. Any other comments?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, just so I can understand this.
Please.
So if it were our desire to have an amendment to this bill, I mean, could you tell me the procedure so that we could, if the committee so would like to recommend cease and desist forever?
The process would be to take an amendment to let the council have them draft it, bring it back to the committee. I intend to move the bill this morning. If you want to amend it, we can amend it on the Senate side. That's my intent. We've got a motion on the floor, and see no other comments. We could have a roll call, please.
Representative Brown?
Aye.
Devlin?
Aye.
Krupp?
Aye.
Merkley?
Aye.
Nelson?
Aye.
Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Bonner?
Aye.
Starr?
Aye. Having the constitutional majority is declared passed. And I've had a request that the bill actually not be put on the consent agenda because of the substance of the issue. Representative Merkley will carry the bill. Okay. We will now go to House Bill 2132 and open a public hearing. House Bill 2132. Again, Kelly Taylor's on the list. This time it's heard personally.
It is Kelly.
We'll let John brief us on the bill.
Members of the committee, House Bill 2132 authorizes the Department of Transportation to issue initial 4-year registration only on new types of vehicles. Changes in the initial registration cycle for new vehicles from 2 years to 4 years. This only applies to new passenger vehicles, light trailers, motorcycles, and mopeds. Vehicle owners will pay the same amount of fees they currently pay, so there are no increase in fees in this bill, but the fees are scheduled in one payment.
Thank you.
Oh, just one thing.
One more thing.
Our fiscals were delivered after the bill, so you should have a copy of the fiscal statement of House Bill 2132, each member, and also the revenue impact statement was just delivered this morning, and you should have a copy of that.
Mr. Chair, I am a bit confused about the revenue impact. Could we have some explanation? Is that looks like an ad to me.
but it,
perhaps I see someone waiting. Don't go on. I'll let Kelly talk.
Thank you.
And perhaps it'll all become clear.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Taylor with the Department of Transportation. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your faith in me. The difference in revenue, Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, is not how much is collected, but when it's collected. It changes just the flow of when you collect it. You're collecting instead of in 2-year increments, a chunk up front in 4 years, and then 2 years after that. We requested this bill to be introduced. It's something that's been kicked around a little bit through legislation in past sessions. We worked quite closely with Department of Environmental Quality, DEQ, to make sure that what we did didn't jeopardize the air quality standards that they're held to by the EPA. And so that's why you see a staggered implementation of when certain counties would take effect. What it does is just like John Leon explained to you. It takes brand new vehicles, first time registration, the initial registration, and registers them for 4 years. And after that, 2 years. And that will save, and we did this for a couple of reasons. It creates efficiencies for us. It creates saving time for the public. It creates one last time they have to go see DMV or DEQ in some areas. And so we felt it was a good thing to do. Most of the bill will become operative January 1 of 2002. And the Portland-related DEQ counties, it will take effect January 1, 2004. And again, that's to allow DEQ to work this into their 10-year plan with the Environmental Protection Agency so that they can keep everything balanced and stay in compliance with what they have to. There is a little bit of programming changes we'll make to the tune of about $38,000 to make this happen. But what it really means is it's fairly staggering the number of customers that this will help and will change. Once this is fully implemented, per biennium, that's 360,000 customers that don't have to mess with DMV at least once.
Yay! We like it.
It's so nice to be loved by everyone. It just warms you all over. Anyway, this is why we introduced the bill. We think it's good government. We think it still gets the process there for registering vehicles, but it does help the public. And that would conclude my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kelly, it looks like we've got a great savings of about $290,000 here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering, you know, that's almost enough to wipe out what you're going to save by closing all those DMV offices. Couldn't we use it to keep those DMV offices open?
Mr. Chair and Representative Krupp, Representative Verger.
you notice I was looking over there.
I think that as the bills go through, and this is part of the governor's recommended budget, I think that we've said all along that it will be ways and means where that sort of discussion happens with the policy option packages and decide exactly where to spend the money. And, you know, if it's the legislature's policy decision that it be in the face-to-face transactions, there's trade-offs with that. We'll have to just decide what's the best way to serve Oregon, and we're willing to work it all out with you.
Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Taylor, in previous sessions, discussions of things relative to this, one of the things that was discussed was that for those attainment areas, the Portland metropolitan area and Medford, that testing vehicles that were that new didn't make a lot of sense because they normally came out well below their established standards. So I would assume that this would mean that the person would only be tested after the first 4 years. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Devlin, that's correct. What you would do when you bought a brand new car is you get 4 years of registration. You would not mess with DMV in the 2 years and in that 4 year period or DEQ.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Therefore, not within your budget, but and it's some time out since it's not effective in the Portland area until 2004. There should be probably some reduction in revenue to DEQ and maybe some reduction or some. Because they will be actually screening less vehicles, maybe not a huge amount, but at least probably 100,000 less vehicles a year, there should be some reduction in expenditures or some for DEQ in those outlying years.
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, I am not familiar enough with DEQ's workload, budget, or anything to know what that effect will be. That seems reasonable, but I can't answer that.
Well, thank you, Chairman.
Yes.
Just a comment.
Sure.
I know it won't be an actual reduction in expenditures.
Yeah.
It will be kind of diminishing the growth in expenditure.
Yeah.
So
Any other questions, preference, Honor?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. what's the difference? We're taking 4 years of money from the new car buyers instead of just 2 years. So how much money are we talking about there? How much will you be able to play with there?
Mr. Chair and Representative Honor, well, you typically pay $30 every 2 years. That means a new car buyer would pay $60 for 4 years rather than $30 and $30. And
now,
so,
statewide, what does that equate to?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Honor, I only have the fiscal to go by. Changing that flow, which is what I was answering to Representative Krupp, in the first biennium, it changes the flow and increases revenue coming in at about $5.5 million statewide. But then it changes the flow 2 years out. I mean, it just changes the flow with what it does. But it doesn't change the total amount collected because it's the same amount.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you. And Chairman Starr, forgive me if this information is here somewhere.
That's okay. Sometimes we have to dig for it.
Yes. Ms. Taylor,
mm-hmm.
You talk about a certain new vehicle
mm-hmm.
and your definition of new.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, brand new, never been registered.
Never been driven.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, never been registered means that instead of having a title that's already been issued, there's a manufacturer statement of origin. It means it's new. It's possible that the car would have been test drove or something like that, but it's never been registered in Oregon or any other state. It's brand new.
So, as I understand, with the follow-up, Chairman Starr, that really we're not just talking about new vehicles then.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson.
Excuse me, if I brought a vehicle over from Idaho.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, if it had been registered in Idaho, you would be re-registering in Oregon. That would not be considered a new vehicle. This is not new to Oregon. This has never been registered anywhere.
Never, ever, anywhere.
Right.
And follow-up, please.
Yes, Representative.
The reason for all counties not being included in this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, all counties are included in this. The differentiate I'm making in there is the DEQ Portland area counties. All counties will become effective 2002, January 1, 2002, except the Portland DEQ-related areas, and those counties become effective January 1, 2004. This does affect all counties.
Follow-up, please. And the reason for that, because Yamhill County is very precious to my heart and to, I hope, Representative Zoners. I'm surprised he didn't ask this question before me, but I'm not understanding this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, when we worked with DEQ, typically the reason why these bills have failed in the past is they were too broad and swept in too many cars, and DEQ would not be able to maintain the air quality standards that they're held to by the federal level, EPA. So they have what's known as a 10-year EPA model in which the mix of all things that they measure and test for are included in order to keep the air quality standards at a certain level. By bringing in the DEQ-related areas in 2004 will allow DEQ to still meet those standards by bringing in other measures and not have these new vehicles. There is some pollution, although Representative Devlin is correct, they mostly pass. There is some level of pollution that comes off of them, so they need to be able to account for that. If they're going to have reduced testing of new vehicles, they need to make sure they can still meet the EPA standards. So they asked us if we would take those counties and start them in 2004, that will allow them to gear up and still meet air quality standards without those cars being part of the pie, if you will.
Follow-up, please.
Yes, Representative Nelson.
This is my last question, I promise.
All right.
Today. I want to thank you. Appreciate Mr. Seeley, and I appreciate you, Ms. Taylor, for educating me because it's very important for me to understand the why we do things in order to explain this to my 83,000 constituents in Yamhill County who are going to blame Representative Zahner for not being included in this, and I want to explain why he didn't do what he should have done. He had them included. And I'm curious in that it would appear to me that if you've tested cars already in other counties, I mean, is there that much difference in the testing? I mean, in 2 years, wouldn't the DEQ have tested most makes and models, and there can't be that much difference in emission or other concerns?
Mr. Chair, members of Nelson, the testing of cars is tied to the registration of vehicles, and so what we've done is we said everyone will get included, but those counties that are DEQ tested, okay, are going to be starting in 2004, and that will allow DEQ to put in a revised plan that will meet the federal requirements so that all of the things that they test and measure can still meet the EPA standard. There is some emissions that comes off of a two-year-old vehicle, and so that is part of the pie that DEQ has to measure and try to maintain. So before we move those cars out too soon, they won't have anything to replace it with. They want to make sure that they can keep the air quality standards at the level the EPA is going to hold their feet to the fire on. So that's the only reason why it's delayed. But all counties, including Yamhill, will get the benefit of a four-year registration. It's just those five counties will start in 2004.
If it's any consolation of Nelson, my county has to wait till 2014.
Thank you. I just want to understand why we didn't go to 4 years during re-registration as well. Is that because of the need for additional pollution monitoring every 2 years?
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, that's correct.
Okay. A couple real quick, two other pieces. The part of the revenue, it sounds to me like it's under the revenue impact, the income. Some of it is because the money's coming in earlier, but aren't there a number of cars that are turned over in less than 2 years that the actual revenue would be greater here because people will be paying for 4 years even though they only utilize 2 years, and is that a significant driver of these figures?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, these figures are derived on how many brand new cars come into the system each biennium, not how many are re-registered after 2 years, because if you were buying a two-year-old car, you would not get the benefit, you would not get to, I mean, it's taken into account. It looked at how many new cars come in each year and said, okay, within these bienniums, how many would be paying for and then wouldn't pay the next biennium, you know. So it is all of it, but it's not I buy a two-year-old car, because if it's already registered before this bill, it's just going to stay on a two-year cycle.
But when the new buyer has to register the car, and so the state gets the 4 years of registration fee plus the 2 years of the new buyer.
No. Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, I buy a brand new car.
Okay.
I pay 4 years. You buy it from me 2 years later, the tags are good for two more years, you don't pay
for
it.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Finally, in regard to the specialty plates, when somebody's considering a salmon plate, or I believe there's several others like that, will this affect demand for those specialty plates and revenue for those special programs? Has there been any effort to establish if people quit buying salmon plates because now they have to pay $60 rather than $30?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berkeley, we did consider that. There's no way to assess that, but the thinking was, the fact is most people finance a car, and to finance $60 more for double salmon plates probably isn't going to deter anybody from buying a salmon plate, and if you're buying it cash, you probably also wouldn't be deterred for $60 more.
Thank you. Representative Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to clarify a couple of items. I think you said pretty clearly about the need to revise the attainment plan for the Portland metropolitan area, and as someone who's dealt with that over the last 15 years, just so the committee understands, I would almost associate it a little bit like the Oregon Health Plan in a sense, in that we have a plan for attainment in the Portland metropolitan area. Anytime we revise it, we have to submit a request to the federal government to revise it. They can reject it or modify it. It takes a lot of time to do that. Previous administrations have been relatively slow in approving those changes. I don't know about the current administration. But I think that's why it takes basically so long. And staying in attainment in the Portland metropolitan area is a very major issue in terms of what its impact is on jobs and employment and everything else. The other thing is, I think we should keep in mind, too, that this four-year period is actually a lot of savings to a lot of people, because most people don't turn their cars over, brand new cars, in that first four-year period. And secondarily, unless the air quality emissions tests double in cost by 2004, they will be saving also in the sense that they will not be going for one additional test that they would have gone to for in the four-year period. So there is actually a savings to the public.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
I don't want to, not keep my word. I wonder if the committee would allow me.
You asked me for some grades.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you. Could I point out, Ms. Taylor, that Yamhill County is a very poor county. I mean, we're one of the fastest growing counties, but, you know, per capita, per individual. And any savings that we could pass on, to our citizens would be very much appreciated. And I would like to now include Representative Brown in this campaign. And I wonder if there's any way that we could appeal that, since there are three representatives of Yamhill County here who also understand the economic plight of our county, far poorer than Multnomah or any of these others, that we might get exempted from this and participate earlier.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I didn't hear the last word. I participated earlier?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I think that would jeopardize the bill, quite frankly, Representative Nelson. I mean, we've worked very closely to make sure that it's something that will work for DEQ to be able to make their standards, and I'm afraid DEQ would then not be able to support the bill.
Any other questions? Thank you, Kelly, very much. Anyone else here to testify on House Bill 2132? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2132 and open a work session on House Bill 2132.
Mr. Chairman, move House Bill 2132 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Devlin has moved House Bill 2132 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? First call. Aye.
Brown?
Aye.
Devlin?
Aye.
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 Nelson?
Aye.
Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Bridger?
Aye.
Hi. Hi. Constitutional majority.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Mandela.
I don't think that this bill actually should be put on the consent agenda, because when people see the revenue impact, they won't understand it unless somebody explains it to them, so it'll be easier.
Would you like to? Representative Devlin.
I'd be happy to.
Thank you. Devlin will carry the bill. Seeing no other items on our agenda, we are adjourned.